In the daytime, we talked about how in the daytime we feel like that's our terrain. We work so hard to wrestle that into the realm in which our affective will operates. The realm in which we cause things to happen. We're in charge. This is our space. But nighttime and sleep and that whole space can often produce a vulnerability to the things that come from places that we're not as conscious of. And that can really impact us. And how in Jacob's life, his first meaningful encounter with God comes in a space like that. A space where he has a dream and meets a God who insists that they have a blessing for him, whether he wants it or not. And then as he goes on in the story, he has to wrestle with whether he wants to give up the necessary amount of control required in order to receive this gift that God seems so determined to give him. And that's sort of where we left that part of the story. Well, from that experience, Jacob kept going geographically. He gets where he's going. He gets to his uncle's place, to Laban's place. And he spends quite a few years there, not least of all because Laban turns out to be just as devious as Jacob, if not more. And Jacob has to work more years than anticipated to get the girl. This is not a sitcom. It takes several years. And along the way, there's all sorts of intriguing things that happen that involve servants and children and herds and wealth and all sorts of chicanery. But if you read the story from the perspective of the trajectory that Jacob seems to be on as a personality going into the story, you realize that in all the compressed years that text actually gives us to work with, the trajectory hasn't really changed. That the way he operates in the world hasn't really changed. That his inclination to protect himself and to do the things that he needs to do to get ahead, at whatever cost, relationally, traumatically in people's lives, whatever realm, he's gonna do it. And he doesn't seem to have a lot of regret. And so whatever happened in that dream, whatever happened in that kind of cataclysmic God experience that he has at Bethel, there doesn't really seem to be that long an echo from that, somehow. And for sure, when we get to this point in the story that we're going to look at today, for sure this idea of a God saying to a person, I've got something special for you that is unique between you and I, and I'm a unique sort of God in the pantheon of gods, has only sort of trickled into the story somehow, because we've got this fascinating story where he runs away from his uncle in the end. He takes all his wealth and sneaks away at night, and when Laban catches up to him, he says, well, his ostensible reason for chasing him down is that he stole all the household idols. You took all the gods. Never mind my daughters and the flocks and everything, but I want my gods back. And it turns out Rachel, one of the wives, has taken the household gods and has them hidden under her camel's saddle. She declines to get up from the saddle and apologizes, saying it's her time of the month. And so he never finds them. And so chicanery and duplicity seems to have become a family theme by now, a way of operating in the world. And what's happening at this point in the story, in particular, is that Jacob is about to meet his comeuppance with his brother, with the person that he ripped off in the first place in this whole tale that sent him running for his life. He's about to encounter Esau again. And he's heard that Esau's coming with hundreds of men. An army, essentially. And so he's understandably a little worried about this. What he does in the face of his concern is typical of Jacob, as far as we can tell in the story. He sends everybody else first. He sends the women and children to the front lines. And he sends all the bunch of flocks with them, too. I mean, you know, like, he's just doing everything he can. And who wouldn't, on one level, to buffer this encounter with his brother, who's coming with an army, and as far as he knows, In all the intervening years, Jacob hasn't really changed the trajectory of how he operates in the world. Why would Esau change the trajectory of how he operates in the world? And if he was just pissed enough to kill Jacob when Jacob ran away the first time, and he's had all these years to kind of gather some momentum in an army, So he does this thing where he just sends everybody else across the river first, and he stays behind. And that's kind of where we catch up with the story. And what I want us to do, and this just comes out of an abiding conviction of mine, that when we read the biblical record, we often make a really serious error. We often make the error of reading it as though it were Western history, which it isn't. And not only that, but reading it as though it were a Western history that God somehow twisted into then being a collection of timeless propositional truths. And all we have to do really is mine a Western history like Western brains would, and we should come away with pan-cultural, pan-time kind of propositions that we can plug into any cultural setting and they'll work. And by work we mean we'll get rich and be healthy and happy. This is not that kind of a story. The whole book isn't that kind of a story. And so if we read it that way, we're liable to really hack things up. And so what I want us to do, though, my conviction is that it's a true story, by which I don't mean all the things I just said, but by which I mean it has truth to tell us. And it has truth to tell us that comes to us divinely attended. And so this is the deepest kind of truth. And it's not always easy to know. We don't always get to know this kind of truth the way we know other sorts of things. We might get to know this kind of truth the way we get to know something that's more like love. So we gotta come at it differently. That said, it's a story that we're invited to enter into all the time. And so I want us to actually read the text together this morning in a way that offers us an invitation for the story that we're going to examine in a moment to be our story. I'm not going to unpack that any more than that, because otherwise I'm going to get into epistemological things, and it's only Trevor and I that are going to still be excited about what's going on. We're going to be really excited, but everybody else is going to be like, is there more coffee? So anyway, wherever there's a bold print like that, that's all of us, okay? And then I'll read the bits in between, which will actually be the written text of the story. So, together.
I'm on a journey. I'm trying to discover who I am and how the world works. Along the way, I've done some good and some harm. I've experienced joy and sorrow. I have relationships that are in good repair and some that need to be restored. Sometimes I behave in ways that are self-interested and self-protective. Other times, my heart and life are open to God. I'm a mixed blessing that needs a blessing.
That night, Jacob got up and took his two wives, his two female servants, and his 11 sons and crossed the ford of the Jabbok. After he had sent them across the stream, he sent over all his possessions. So Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him till daybreak. When the man saw that he could not overpower him, he touched the socket of Jacob's hip, so that his hip was wrenched as he wrestled with the man. Then the man said, "Let me go, for it is daybreak." But Jacob replied, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." Together.
God, I want your blessing, but it's hard for me to let go, to submit and receive rather than to be in charge. I would rather wrestle a blessing to the ground than give up and have it given to me.
The man asked him, "What is your name?" "Jacob," he answered. Then the man said, "Your name will no longer be Jacob, but Israel, because you have struggled with God and with humans and have overcome." Together.
God, do you have a new name for me? Is there a way that I need to be thinking of and understanding who I am in your eyes that I need to learn?
Jacob said, "Please tell me your name." But he replied, "Why do you ask my name?" And he blessed him there. So Jacob called the place Peniel, saying, "It is because I saw God face to face, and yet my life was spared." The sun rose above him as he passed Peniel, and he was limping because of his hip. God, I am grateful for your grace and your mercy and for your blessing. Help me to walk on and to remember not only the wrestling, but also the blessing. I said in the blurb, and if you're here as a guest and you're wondering what the blurb is, every week there's an email that goes out that talks about a little bit about what's going on in the teaching time in particular on a given morning. And if you want to be part of that, just you can talk to me or anybody that looks like they know where the coffee is. I can probably help you out. But in the blurb this week, I talked about what's in a name and about my own journey to kind of the sensation of discovering what my name's meant and some of the impact that that's had. And there's a part of this story that I want to focus on, and that's why I wrote about that. It's like this weird moment in the story where it's about names. And it's this moment where there's this kind of a little Hebrew pun that happens here between names and the word for names and the word for dust. But somehow in this wrestling with whatever kind of cosmic divine being this is that Jacob is wrestling with, and the text can't seem to make up its mind, history's waffled as well, but generally the consensus is in one shape or another this is a wrestling match with God. And so at some point Jacob has God pinned. And you know from the rest of the story that it's a chosen submission on the part of the divine being. Because just a touch and does that, right? But he's got him pinned in the dirt and he says, "I want you to bless me and I'm not going to let you up until you do." And then this being says, "Well, tell me your name." Like the being doesn't know his name. Okay? It doesn't matter how we understand this being to be nature. It doesn't matter if we think of this as an angel or of God's self in some shape or of something else from the realm that we perceive least well that is divine that he's wrestling with. Any one of those natured beings would have the information. Anybody who walked through camp would have the information about who this is. So the question is not actually an information question. There's something else going on. Do you remember the last time, you don't have to answer this, it's rhetorical, the last time in the story that Jacob was asked for his name in the context of blessing? The last time Jacob insisted on being blessed was with his father. In that narrative that launches this whole thing where he rips off Esau for his blessing. And he comes to his blind father and says, "Father, you need to bless me." And his father says to him, "What's your name?" And Jacob says, "My name is Esau." And he lies to his father to get a blessing. And that so sets the tone for Jacob's story that when we come to this point in the story, there are any number of things God could say to Jacob at this point in the story by way of chastisement. There's reams of material to haul out, to say, there's a reason why I shouldn't bless you. You're a duplicitous, self-serving, arrogant, fill in the blank. You don't merit blessing in any way. Let's talk about that, and then you can let me up and I'll go. And instead, what he says is, "Tell me your name." What does Jacob's name mean? It means heel grabber. It means what he's been doing. This whole story. And what does Jacob say this time? When he comes to God and says, "You need to bless me or I won't let you go." And God says, "Tell me your name." He says, "My name is Jacob. I am who I am." He just owns it. And that is the key that unlocks the blessing in this story. Isn't that interesting? Again, I'm not trying to write a formula. I'm not trying to write a proposition. This is not a new
prayer of Jabez or something, or whatever. You know. This is not that. It's an intriguing story, though. And I think it has something to say to us. I think one of the things it has to say to us is that it's really difficult to do that maneuver that we talked about Jacob starting to try to learn in that first dream, that tension-filled maneuver where we're wrestling with giving up our assertiveness and our control and our protection of self and being vulnerable in a way that means we can actually receive something that comes to us as gift. And that's a constant struggle. That's a constant dilemma. We don't step out of that dance ever. If we're a saint, we get better at it. You know? If we're not, we get better slower. I don't know. What's different about being a saint? I'll never know. So, but you know, that's kind of as good as it gets, is the point. And when God comes to Jacob and just says, just own it. And we can get on with this thing that I've promised you that you weren't looking for anyway. But you have to be able to receive it, or the gift kind of becomes moot. We have that much, we being humans, seem to have that much agency in the world, don't we? That God would bless us, and we would actually get, to some degree, to choose to keep it to ourselves. That's ridiculous. And it seems to be true. Despite the whole arc of the story, if we take the story seriously, despite the whole arc of the story being, if I give you something good and I have something good for you to give, if I give you something good and you open yourself and you receive it, the reason I've given it to you is so you'll give it away, not so you'll hoard it. But it seems like we've got enough freedom in how we operate in the world that we actually can, to some degree, hoard it. I'm not saying it'll never come back and bite us in the ass. I mean, watch the story of North America this week. You know, watch what we're doing with the things that we have that we might call blessings. One of the things that seems to be thematic in the story is that our pleas to God to bless us are linked in some mysterious but real way to our continuing to wrestle with being vulnerable to blessing, being actually open to it, knowing that when it comes, what we give for it is control, what we hand over, if you will, is control of the story. And that's not an easy thing to do. God didn't ask Jacob his name because God didn't know it. He wanted to know if Jacob knew it. He wanted to know if the person that wanted a blessing was ready to acknowledge just what sort of person it was that was going to be blessed.